This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and Bradley's taking a break this week, so I'm joined by my colleague from Cedars, Andrew Jewell.
Hi there.
This show is brought to you by Shobi, an iPad app for paperless classrooms. Shobi makes it easy to assign, collect, and review student work, and to provide rich feedback with annotations, voice notes, and more. Also by Geeks with Juniors, a website dedicated to helping parents and teachers discover the best educational children's apps on the App Store. And finally by Jam Software, our friends who make the Casper suite for iOS and Mac administration. And we'll tell you more about all of those as the show goes on. So, welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much, Fraz. It's great to be here.
Yeah. So, I think it's Friday night. It's 10 o'clock. We just closed the school. Mm-hmm. For the year, so we're all a little demob happy tonight. So it's just going to be a kind of relaxed show, and we're just going to talk through, you know, some of the stuff that you do, some of the stuff that we've seen together over the past few years, and kind of where things are going.
Excellent.
Sound good?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So first things first, though, there is some interesting news about iTunes U, and it's a major revision of the iOS app. And what's in there are two sort of keystone features of the release. Number one is that all of the web-based tools for what we call iTunes U Course Manager, which mm-hmm. is the teacher's tools for creating and editing the courses and managing materials and so on, all of that's now being built into the iOS app.
Wow.
Which is something I think we've been waiting for since I think the first day we actually ever saw it.
This is the thing we've been kind of, we can't wait to be able to build these things on the iPad.
Yeah, because I know you've been doing and I've been doing as well. There's been a lot of interest in training around iTunes U, and I think it's always been something that's been a bit hard to explain.
Yeah.
Over time, you know, here's the iOS experience, here's what the students see, blah, blah, blah. So how do we make that? Oh, well, we go back to the PC and we do this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So I think you and I had an experience where we were doing iTunes U training in Edinburgh where we showed the teachers a number of ways to do things to create materials on the iPad.
Yeah.
And that was the easiest way to do it, if you think about using Explain Everything or something. You know, it was much easier to do it on the iPad than to do it on the Mac. But then we had to go through this kind of USB cable dance to get those files back to the Mac to upload them to iTunes U. So,
yeah, this feels, I mean, that really feels like the moment we've been waiting for iTunes U for a while. And it will certainly make training days a whole lot more straightforward and fun, I think.
Yeah, because up till now we've had to, you know, the bill of materials for a training day has been enormous because it's been everybody needs an Apple ID and an iPad and a Mac or a PC running Chrome or Safari, which none of them ever do because they've always got PCs running Internet Explorer in school.
So
it's always been a bit of a fuss to make that happen. But
even to be able to have the kind of flexibility to develop your courses wherever you are.
Yeah.
You know, you know, if you're traveling, to be able to sit and work a little bit on your course or, you know, post assignments or add materials as you go, that's going to be just brilliant.
Yeah. That's a big deal for me personally. I mean, I remember one time where I think you were covering my class and I was supposed to have posted something in iTunes U and I hadn't done it. and I was in the back of a taxi going through the middle of London trying to somehow find a way to log into iTunes U on the web on my iPad so that I could just click the post button. So being able to just do that, maybe you even still type them on your Mac or whatever, but just being able to send them out from your iPad is going to be super powerful.
It seems to be as well that that's increasingly a feature of, you know, being able to sort of take materials and then to open them in other apps. And mm-hmm. it's nice that iTunes U is becoming one of those options. You can create something, like you say, and then you can obviously open it in, you know, in iTunes U, the way that you can in, you know, iMovie or Explain Everything or some of these other apps already.
Yeah, so that's going to be a feature of this ability to edit, create and edit courses on the iPad, is to be able to take a file from an app that you're using on the iPad and open it in iTunes U and be offered the chance to upload it. Very much the same way that you do with Shobi, one of our sponsors, or Google Drive or Dropbox or something like that. That's the way that we've traditionally uploaded files to web services on iOS. And that's going to be possible. And the other thing that's going to be possible is selecting things from the camera roll, which is kind of the obvious partner of that other feature.
Yeah, so for example, you could take your instructional video that you've just made and Explain Everything, put it in your camera roll, and then directly from there to iTunes U.
Yeah.
which is what you always want to do anyway. So that's great.
And what I hope with that as well is it will encourage people to preserve higher quality as well, because they're not trying to get it into the size. They can email it to themselves or something like that, or whatever ways we used to use to get videos off the iPad onto the Mac in order to upload them to Course Manager on the web.
Now that's going to be really exciting.
Yeah. So that's those are some of the main features. The other thing, there's one other thing I think I've forgotten that I was told. Cross-store searching for materials is a thing that's been put into this as well. So what you'll be able to do is you'll be able to search for specific topics, and you'll be shown results for that search from all of the stores. So you'll be able to see, say you search for, I don't know, like chemical bonds, right? You'll see apps that show 3D chemical bonds. You'll see iTunes U materials that are about chemical bonds.
Books.
You'll see books about them.
Yep.
If there exist songs about chemical bonds, you'll see songs about chemical bonds as well. And if there are movies about chemical bonds, you'll probably be...
We could write a song about chemical bonds.
Yeah, I think they might be giants. I've probably covered one of those, I'm sure. But that's something that's being built into Course Manager as well.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to be an interesting one for people who are trying to assemble resources into a course. You work in primary, me working in secondary, we use iTunes U in different ways.
Yeah.
And I think in some ways, like a primary focus on iTunes U, would you say, is maybe a little more kind of materials focused rather than course focused?
Yes, probably slightly less focused on the assignments. I mean, I use iTunes U quite a lot to make a kind of practical way of flipping the classroom.
Right.
And being able to kind of like extend learning at home and deliver kind of open outcome tasks.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, to be able to, so the materials for me are going to be, they're a huge part of it, you know, from the web or things that I've already created on the iPad myself.
Mm-hmm.
They'll be huge.
Yeah. So that I think that those are all very interesting features, and I think many of them will be very welcome as well. I mean, I know it's something that Brad and I have talked about in the show for, well, I think fully all the years since iTunes U was a thing on iOS.
Yeah.
We said, you know, from like the second day I saw it, I thought, why can't I make a course on this thing? And now we can do that. So that's going to be really fantastic to be able to do that. The other thing that's being done on iTunes U is they're adding threaded discussions to posts.
Mm, okay.
Which is quite interesting because it sort of reaches into an area that iTunes U previously did not touch really, which is allowing the student to sort of contribute back to the experience of the course.
So will that allow you then to have a dialogue between you as the teacher and the student?
My understanding so far, having not seen the user interface for it, is that it's a dialogue between the class and the rest of the class, including the teacher.
Okay.
So it's not like in Shobi, for example, where you can have like a private space between you and an individual pupil about their work.
Sure.
But it's more facilitating class discussion about the assignment or about the post.
So, for example, one of the things we did in iTunes U with the class was we looked at the question of whether or not it was a good idea to have a national DNA database.
Mm-hmm.
So that discussion question could be opened up in iTunes U.
And you could basically develop right there.
Yeah, which is really could be great.
Yeah, no, I think that's very interesting. I think it opens up another way of like setting some homework that's not like a hand in all the time. You know, your homework is to contribute to the discussion.
Yeah,
that's going to go on all week, and then you know we'll come back on Friday and we'll bring it all together and do something.
Yeah, and there's lots of kind of like exciting possibilities to work. You know, to enroll. You know, people, children or students on your course from different places. So mm-hmm. you could have a shared course, for example, with a school in Wales. Like, remember, we did the project mm-hmm. in Wales where we did a kind of collaborative project. So we could potentially now deliver that through iTunes U and have some of the discussion from both perspectives within the course.
Yeah. I think that all seems possible. And, I mean, I was having this conversation quite recently when I was doing some training with another school who were sort of getting into iPads and iTunes U, and one of the teachers asked me, well, we've used Edmodo before, why would I use iTunes U?
Yeah.
And the answer I had to sort of give at that point was, well, you'd kind of use them both in concert. And I think, I certainly haven't used all the features of Edmodo in my experience, but I think with this new feature in iTunes U, you could bring some of that into iTunes U as well.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's going to replace the whole of Edmodo for people who are deeply embedded in using that, but for people who are coming to this new, which let's face it, is a majority of schools, we'll talk about that in a bit as well, I think it saves them having to add on another thing. You know, so in times past, you might have had Shobi for assignment submission and iTunes U for the course, and then Edmodo for the class discussion.
Yeah.
And that means you can now just have the two things, and then, you know,
yeah,
maybe next year you'll take out Shobi as well. I don't know, and iTunes U will actually do the whole thing.
Yeah.
But, maybe not next year, but at some point.
Yeah. That sounds like a really, really exciting development.
Yeah, no, it's nice to see iTunes U getting a little love.
Yeah, and I think it works for us. I mean, obviously, we're right at the moment of developing new courses, and I think certainly in Scotland, that's the situation many people are at. So to be able to develop them in iTunes U and with so much kind of flexibility in what you can do and how you can add a lot of the materials that you probably have already got for some of the courses that you deliver, it will be great.
One of the things I think is quite interesting with this whole idea of being able to edit and create posts and upload materials on the fly is that you can now use your iTunes U course as a place to archive things that happened in the classroom on the fly.
Yeah.
You know, so for example, I teach this course that I use as my kind of iTunes U example, this history of computing course. And I have pre-prepared posts that I put out every day of the course for discussion in the classroom. But then we do things on the whiteboard, you know, we have the kids write on the board or do things with post-it notes, and we tend to photograph a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
But it kind of falls through the cracks quite often to get that stuff back into the iTunes U course.
Yeah.
Whereas now doing that, I could just photograph it with my iPad, and then, you know, every post has a follow-up post with all the things we made in the classroom, which is helpful for revision as well.
I mean, that's exactly I can see that in the same way with, you know, some of the video that I've got from the reflection booth.
Mm-hmm.
So you could have an assignment, and then the student's giving you a kind of video reflection on the assignment, so a bit of assessment, which then could just become another part of the course, which could then ultimately inform whatever assignments follow on.
You better tell people what the reflection booth is.
Yeah, well, that's good.
It's not the detention.
Well, it sounds very grand.
It seems either grand or highly sinister, I'm not sure.
Well, the reflection booth... we started this well before we had the iPad, but it basically is a cupboard in my classroom. It has been for the past few years, which originally cited a Mac where kids would just go in, you know, close the door, and then they would kind of record a bit of video assessment on Photo Booth initially, and then that would kind of inform me of how they were getting on with whatever piece of work that they were doing, and also how my teaching was. But obviously, since the iPad's come, that's a lot more easy, straightforward, because they can just take their iPad in there, and those videos are now part of, you know, their video report card, so they can just drop them straight into the report card or their pupil profile that you can we can make them on Book Creator or whatever. So there's lots we can do with that video now.
It's
now
part of a workflow.
Yeah, it's much more part. And even with Erasma, we've kind of done a little bit of experimentation with taking some of that video and even just putting it on the classroom wall effectively, you know, so it becomes something that brings the classroom to life. So, so some of that video, if I could feed that back into the course in iTunes U, that would be great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's going to open up a lot of new behaviours in the classroom with the fact that it's, I think very much in the same way that iOS itself brought new behaviours in the classroom because it had things like microphones and cameras integrated.
Yeah.
And like the transition you just discussed there from having it on a Mac, which is standalone and not really integrated with the rest of your workflow, to having it on a pupil's own device, which is in with all their other data, I think you'll start to see similar kind of new teacher behaviours possible with this new version of iTunes U.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to be really powerful. Obviously, I haven't seen it yet, but I think one of the sort of powerful things about iTunes U is the fact that it also has this back end by Apple, which is you know, as big as you need it to be, and fast and stable and so on.
So we can look forward to Monday.
We look forward indeed. Well, we look forward to now, listeners, because you're not getting this until I've actually had to agree to not post the show until after Apple tells you about it first.
Okay.
So that's topic one, and Let's tie in with that and talk a little bit about Shobi. Shobi is one of our sponsors for the show. They've sponsored us a few times. And the thing about Shobi is it does the bit that iTunes U has typically not done, right? Shobi is an iPad app for paperless classrooms. And what Shobi lets you do is it lets teachers quickly and easily kind of assign, collect and review student work on their iPads. And the thing I really like about Shobi is that you can then, you have this individual channel. So where we discussed about iTunes U having this sort of chat classroom room kind of experience, Shobi has this individual channel between you and every student. So you can send, grade or mark a paper and send the feedback back to only that student. Whereas with iTunes U, it would go back to everybody. So you wouldn't normally do that through iTunes U. So Shobi does similar things to iTunes U in the sense that you can open things in Shobi to upload them, which is powerful. And Shobi kind of led the way in that, and iTunes U is only just now getting the same kind of feature. Students can complete assignments with Shobi's built-in tools as well. You don't necessarily have to be using an app, and it keeps everyone organized with individual student assignment folders, email notifications, push notifications, and some information. Shobi Basic is completely free, and teachers can try it out with students in just a few minutes and get started by downloading Shobi on the App Store or visiting shobi.com. And Shobi is also offering a special deal for school admins listening to this show. You can buy Shobi Pro for 5 teachers and upgrade an extra 5 teachers to Shobi Pro for free. So that's 10 teachers in total and all their students on a Shobi Pro for a full year. So visit shobi.com/outofschool for more details.
Thanks
to them. Yeah.
And they've just had a big new update. So that's
really nice. Yes, I just got an email about that. I think it was literally just today or maybe yesterday. They've basically they've done their iOS 7 update on Shobi and it's really nice.
Yeah, there's lots of nice features and lots of nice new design elements as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let's move on. Today is the last day of term.
Yay.
How's your year been?
How's my year been? Mine, it's been really busy. Mm-hmm. Really, really busy. But it's been a really good year. It's been a great year. I mean, that's the year I was coming to the end of year 4.
That's year 4.
With the iPad.
Yeah.
So I guess this will be the end of year 1 with a camera.
Yes, indeed it is.
Which is amazing to think, because it just seems like it's hard to even remember the days before we could do some of these video features. And,
So reflect on that a little bit. I mean, what has that brought into your classroom that wasn't there before?
In terms of the camera?
Yeah.
In some ways, it's more what it's taken out in the sense that I have no Mac in my classroom anymore. We're purely on the iPad. But I think the biggest thing is allowed me to kind of explore the whole idea that we first came to with the iPad of an open outcome task in a much, much more kind of exciting way for the students.
Mm-hmm.
So it has just broadened the outcomes, really, if you like, for them. So if we say to them, for example, we did a question about, and we did looking at inventions and discoveries, and we said to them, okay, what's the difference between an invention and a discovery? And the assignment in iTunes U for the kids to look at home was, make something that shows the difference or explores the difference between inventions and discoveries. And that kind of make something question for them now, because they have, every student's got the camera and the video and they can use, you know, Morpho and Telegami and lots of fun apps as well. It really has broadened the kind of scope of the outcome, which I think has made the whole experience a whole lot richer for them. And we've had some fantastic, you know, outcomes created by students where they've gone away and they've done TV broadcasts, or they've done, podcast type outcomes, or documents and books and things. And that has just become a lot more kind of just part of life. Like, it doesn't feel like anymore that this is something that is being done for the sake of making the movie. It's actually much, much more now kind of back to the learning and sort of really much more about the learning, but it happens that you can make that in a fun way or an interesting way. Or
That's interesting. I mean, I think I've been kind of harping on about this for more than a year now, that, you know, the source of all casual learning in our society is YouTube.
Yeah.
And the video I mean, instructional video has got a kind of bad reputation because of the way that the Open University used it in the 1980s.
Yeah.
Where it was like a 32-year-old guy with a bad beard and, you know, a funny jumper.
Yeah.
Standing at a whiteboard and telling you something, like just a video lecture, very, you know, it's almost like the way that when cinema first came in, they did a stage play and just put a camera in front of the stage.
Yeah.
And those early lectures, and even if you look at some of the stuff from the sort of older universities in iTunes U, I mean, one of the first things I ever downloaded from iTunes U was a video from, I think it was Duke University, where the first thing you see is a professor standing up there writing on an overhead projector.
Yeah.
You know, so, and it's stuff like that. But I think if you look at YouTube now, and you try and learn things from people, when you see people learn things, where do they go to learn something?
Absolutely. Like, I mean, my kids, know. Even like, you know, the loom band craze that's taken mm-hmm. over the world. I mean, my little girl was making the most incredibly intricate, like, designs. And I was like, how on earth did you manage to do that? And she went, well, watch this. And she showed me a video of another girl who was probably about an equivalent age.
Yep.
And it was just on YouTube. And it was like, well, mm-hmm. I want to know how to do that. Here's the go-to place.
You know? And I think what strikes me about that is that the quality of information that you can get, the amount of detail and the sheer amount of hours of footage that are available about these things is beyond anything that a commercial provider could ever justify making. Yeah. And I think video is becoming just such a common part of the... And I hate to just add the word literacy to everything, because I think people just say, thing I like plus literacy means we should teach it in a school. But like that kind of media literacy about what makes a good instructional video, what makes a good entertainment video. Because the other thing I saw when your class got their iPads with the camera for the first time was that within days, you know, when you sent that kind of work home and said, make something that shows you know the difference, you were getting back things that had, tell me what it was, you know, it was pastiches of horrible histories and different kinds of TV shows. MasterChef was getting parodied in a thing about, you know, tell me more about that.
Yeah, I mean, and that was, you know, so we had different types of videos. So there was, yeah, two in fact, it was April and Katie, I think, did the Horrible Histories kind of sketch show, mm-hmm. and they did that, but it was all about the invention of toilet paper,
mm-hmm.
Which was just an absolute riot. And ultimately, I couldn't put it on the blog because it was just a bit too funny. And it actually had, they'd obviously done a whole bunch of research, mm-hmm. and it was really interesting stuff, and they'd done a whole lot to that and come up with a fantastic, you know, piece of learning. And yeah, there was the MasterChef thing, so they kind of parodied MasterChef a later point, I think that was. Other people did a kind of like iMovie compilation where they'd used kind of like different characters, some of them avatars that they'd made with Telegami, and then sort of themselves playing other characters, and it was mm-hmm. much more documentary style. And that was just amongst outcomes. I mean, some kids were just still going with, I want to create a newsletter,
mm-hmm.
and they were just writing basically an essay of their research with kind of pictures that they'd found and stuff. So, I mean that's interesting because, you know, that was delivered through iTunes U, and at the time, you know, I thought about iTunes U as very much a kind of secondary thing, and I wasn't convinced about its kind of application or its. It's you know, I wasn't convinced that kids in the primary would be excited by iTunes U.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that just blew me away was when at the end of the term, that term, and I said, well, what have you enjoyed this term? And almost all of them said, well, we just love iTunes U. They loved learning through iTunes U, and they loved the way that it was delivered. And I think, I'm not exactly sure what it was that appealed to them, but they really, really, really liked it.
I think it's possibly a generational thing. I think that there's maybe, you know, we've had computer-based training for a very long time.
Yeah.
And it's historically not been very good. You know, it's mostly been, you know, here's a PowerPoint, except we're saving money on the lecture and we're just going to have you advance the PowerPoint while somebody talks to you on a recording. But I think, you know, we're getting now to the stage where, like, you and I had access to some online learning materials as perhaps university students.
Yeah.
And now our children are growing up in a home environment where the parents take that for granted.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes that's what has to happen before the children can fully grow up in that world,
yeah,
is that the parents have to understand, and we have to model for them that we do that as well. So April, for example, she sees my wife using YouTube to learn how to make sugar paste flowers for her wedding cakes, right? And that's a fully supported and understood and accepted mode of learning in our household. Is I go on YouTube and I look at somebody else doing it, and then I copy them, right? And that's what my wife does. That's what I do. I mean, I'm buying this new car, and the way I decided that car was the car I wanted to get was because there's a guy on YouTube has got like 50 hours of him driving around in a Nissan Leaf. Like 50 hours of about one car. You know, and there's I go to the dealership and I test drive the car, and there's nothing I don't know about that car.
Yeah.
And basically what I'm doing is I'm seeing, does this seat feel comfortable?
Yeah.
And is it big enough for my shoulders?
Yeah.
You know, and it's actually more about my physical dimensions in the car rather than about learning about the product, because I've done all that before.
Yeah, and what's really interesting about that kind of thing, when we're speaking specifically about video, and I've noticed this over the year, that not often we'll speak to teachers, say for example, if they're a geography teacher, they don't teach video production.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they're, you know, if they're an English teacher and they're doing Shakespeare, they're not teaching animation. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes, you know, you think, well, okay, so why would you do this as an animation or a video? Because, you know, the outcome and the learning, you really are, as an English teacher, the learning's all about the English.
Mm-hmm.
Or the, you know, but what's interesting is that, that the way that their society is with video is that, and I've noticed this over the past year, that the quality of the videos that the kids produce is increasing rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a part of that is because of the quality that, of the videos that they're watching on an instructional basis.
Mm-hmm.
So in actual fact, they're being taught almost subliminally how to make a video and how what makes a good video, because they're just watching YouTube videos all the time, and the quality of these videos that are being posted online is increasing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not having to teach animation skills when I'm doing what makes it, what's a good invention. They're able to know a whole bunch about animation I don't actually have to teach.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's, the outcomes are increasingly good.
Because they've seen both good and bad examples.
Yeah.
And YouTube's got everything. And it shows, I think they learn, they know because one helped them and one didn't.
Yeah.
That if you do this, it's good. But if your camera work is bad or if the sound's terrible, you know, they've seen enough of that stuff now that they know a little bit better.
Yeah.
I'm not saying there's no place for teaching those production skills, but I think, you know, don't know what you think about this, but, you know, as a primary teacher, what kind of skills do you have to deliver for use in secondary schools that you wouldn't have had to do before?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the big things we focus on from so early on is presentation skills.
Yeah.
Because we're looking at from primary one, I mean, like you're talking 5-year-old kids,
mm-hmm.
where they're doing show and tell, where they're bringing, but that is so significant now because that becomes a foundational part of their school life, and it right up into secondary, which obviously you mm-hmm. get, you're doing a kind of much more advanced level of presentation skills in your classes.
Yeah.
But we do that right from the beginning in primary.
Mm-hmm.
And we're looking at communication skills, whether it be kind of overtly or kind of covertly in the back door of whatever other outcomes and areas, curriculum areas that we're looking at. But communication skills are so vital in terms of what the kids are doing. And secondary teachers are just expecting it in our school now,
mm-hmm.
you know, that they have these fundamental skills.
Yeah, I mean, in time past, communication skills were, I could write a functional piece of writing.
Yeah.
You know, that was, in some cases, the sum total of what we consider communication skills, or I could draw as well, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And now it encompasses presentation, it encompasses argument, it encompasses discussion in group work, it encompasses video production, animation, digital artwork.
Yeah, and I think also the ability to reflect, you know, talking about a reflection mm-hmm. booth, I think that is a huge thing as well now, not because they're able to, that they're competent at assessing materials, say in iTunes U, they can assess the quality of the material, they can assess the quality of one another's work, so they can do peer assessment, and it is genuinely informative and significant, the assessments that the kids make of each other's work.
Mm-hmm.
So they're very much part of the whole education process in a way that I don't know if they always were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes I remember peer assessment being spoken about as the new thing, and and finding it very difficult to get peer assessment to give you quality assessment.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas now, because I think the kids are much more kind of consumers of their own society than, and we're kind of helping them with that, if you like,
mm-hmm.
they know what makes a good movie, they know what makes a good video, they know if one of their classmates has stuck to the point or has made a good point or has argued their point well or has, you know, spoken clearly. They know all these kind of things, and they're able to kind of, you know, communicate what's good and what's bad in a way that actually is genuinely effective.
It feels to me a wee bit like the boundaries being blurred between producer and consumer.
Yeah.
You know, and people often have this discussion in terms of, like, the phrase that you just said there, consumers of their society and their culture, as people use that in a derogatory fashion, right? Particularly people in computer science, actually. They say that because the phrase that's used all the time is, we want children to be producers of technology, not consumers. And that's fine. I'm not against that. But I think having a greater recognition of the fact that we are all consumers is very important, and consuming in an intelligent fashion is really important to me. And I think also that being able to make your own informs your consumption as well.
Absolutely.
And I think both of these things actually fit together quite nicely, in that when you're exposed, because in times past also in schools, you're often only exposed to very high quality materials. You weren't exposed to anything that wasn't really good. And I think being exposed to the vast range of things that are available on the internet allows children to be much more discriminating in mm-hmm. terms of what they find useful and what they don't. Because if you only ever show them the BBC website and Oxford University Press books, and, you know, when we were in school, we had SRA, which is a kind of close reading scheme, and everything was, you know, professionally written, fully edited, you know, to publication standard. Yeah. And it was either that or it was nothing, right? Or it was either that or it was what you did.
Yeah.
And the goal was always just to get from where you were as like a five-year-old to somebody who could write for the Oxford University Press. And I think now there's exposure to so many steps in between that it's actually easier to climb the ladder, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
And I think what's really interesting about that was you speaking there about, you know, you think about when the iPad first came into our hands,
mm-hmm.
you know, the thing we always used to kind of sort of laugh at in the years, in the year or two following getting the iPad was when, you know, when it first came out and people said, yeah, this isn't a device for making anything, it's just a device for consuming content.
Yeah.
And we kind of went, once we started using it in school, it became abundantly clear that this was a device for making, this was a creation device as well as, but it's interesting now to be able to reflect, yes, so we can do all that production, mm-hmm. but like you say, the effect that it's had on the content consumption and the curation of the content as well, and the students being able to take part in looking at content in a completely different way. So, you know, it's not about production or consumption, but it's actually both that are
transformed. What you might call that in the middle is like a remix culture.
Yeah.
Which we've kind of talked, that phrase has been around for a long time, but I think what we're starting to see is it coming sort of being reified in our classroom as, you know, this is what it actually looks like when students remix and create. And it's essentially a creative act, even if you're not making every single part of it yourself.
Yeah, and it has to be like that, because I think if you give the kids access to the web, you know, and to the internet, then you have to be able to, the learning then is about information, it's about validity, and it's about personalising the information and researching and how you adapt.
And being a discriminating consumer of all that information as well.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of funny because I was... I've been teaching this administration and IT course up to National 5, which is the first kind of level of exams in Scotland. And it's funny because there's a part of that course where it talks about what makes a good and reliable website. And essentially the textbook sort of basically says, but doesn't actually say this, but it sort of implies that if it looks like the BBC, it's a good website. You know, and I think it's the partly is the most British attitude to the internet you could possibly imagine. But, you know, that reflects that earlier time of if it's professionally written in, you know, or if it's spoken in received pronunciation, it's written in the Queen's English, it's therefore good and useful. Whereas anything that's written, you know, somewhat casually, a blog post, or created on the fly, like a guy sitting in his car holding his phone making a video that shows you more detail than any professional video has ever shown.
Yeah.
That somehow that's not quite as worthy. You know, and again, that seems to have been my obsession for the past 6 months is, you know, what is real and what's valid and what's not.
Yeah.
And it's becoming increasingly difficult to pin that down, I think.
Yeah. And you're looking at really, people used to talk about 21st century skills, and I suppose some of these things we're talking about, that is exactly what we really were coming to,
mm-hmm.
you know, in terms of developing students to interact with some of these things and different types of content and assess what it is exactly that they're wanting to do and how they do it. And so, yeah, I mean, very exciting times, really.
I agree. I think there's more to explore, I think. But it's been the impact of the camera has been very interesting. I think I've used it certainly more in secondary. I've used it more as a kind of as a data capture device, than as a creativity device as such. That partly speaks to, you know, the nature of upper secondary teaching as well. But it is what it is. But I think the experience that you're having is very interesting. And I've mentioned this on the show before, but I looked at our device management server recently, and what I saw there was that your class had made the most data out of every your iPads were the fullest, and it's actually a bell curve as you go up to school. The primary one and secondary five and six actually make about the same amount of data, which is kind of damning for upper secondary. But and then it builds up to primary five, six, seven, and then it steps down from there after that as well.
Yeah.
So the rate of creation is actually an S curve across your school career. You start slowly, then you have the explosive and creative part in the middle of your schooling, and then it tails off again.
Yeah, and to me, I think that is at the moment where we are. I mean, I think that is obviously for us a feature of the exam system that we're working within.
Mm-hmm.
But I think for me as a teacher at the kind of upper end of the primary school, it gives me a kind of feeling of responsibility that the kids that come to us and through that stage in their lives, that is very much part of what the experience is, the kind of push into creativity and encouragement to develop skills and so many of these things that we've spoken about. That mm-hmm. because, like you say, it might be the moment in their lives where they get a chance to experience some of these things and to look at learning like that.
Yeah, and in some ways that's where you can stretch your legs in a consequence-free manner. You know, there's obviously assessment, but you know, it's not going to be the case that, you know, if you do it this way, that's going to be the wrong way and you failed.
Absolutely.
You know, there's room to explore in a very safe fashion at that stage of the education. Yeah. Good. That's interesting. There's some other things we're going to talk about there. I don't know if they're as interesting as that conversation, but, you know, obviously this year also saw the introduction of iOS 7 into the school.
For me, the huge impact of that can really be summed up practically in one word, which would be AirDrop.
Really?
As a classroom teacher.
Yeah.
That's been huge.
Mm-hmm.
It's a simple thing, but like you were talking earlier about, you know, Shobi and iTunes U and uploading from the camera roll, but to be able to drop videos, for example, video content to the kids, bypassing email.
Upload to the network at all.
Yeah. I mean, that has been just huge. And sharing content and collaborative working on projects between groups or students or mm-hmm. classes or just by being able to just quickly drop files onto one another's iPad, I think that's been great.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of these things that I think for a lot of these things, there are classroom management strategies that you have to have in place. Consequently, but at the same time, the benefit of these things is huge.
Yeah, and you know, we've talked in previous shows about deployment approaches to things like that, and I kind of feel it's the same as with the camera. Like, I can turn it off if I have to, but I don't want to turn it off straight away because of the things that you can see in your classroom when it's just a standard capability that everybody has. You know, if somebody is airdropping inappropriate materials or whatever, we'll find out about that.
Yeah.
And we'll deal with it at that stage. But you know, as long as the students know that that's possible,
yeah,
that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's take a break and do another sponsor. Who's next on the list? Let's talk about Geeks with Juniors. Geeks with Juniors is a website dedicated to helping parents and teachers discover the best educational children's apps on the App Store. Every day, they publish a review of the latest and best apps for kids. Because the reviews are written from the perspectives of a parent, an educator, and a developer, you get some insights that people who care for the children's education would appreciate. With the recent updates, you can now find guides for apps that suit kids from 1 to 5 years old. These guides are written out of their experience of reviewing thousands of apps. So you can learn more about what other great stuff you can find by visiting their website at geekswithjuniors.com/guides. And you can follow them on Twitter at geekwithjunior. So yeah, thanks to them for sponsoring the show. Sounds like a kind of thing that people need.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think, you know, you and I go to schools all the time, and that's the first conversation we always have is, how do you find apps?
Yeah. Yeah, and how do you know that's any good?
Yeah.
And so that's great. I mean, that's still the question teachers, most teachers ask is, well, what apps do we need to, what apps do you, should we get?
Yeah,
that's good.
And you know, I'm aware that, you know, there's a list that I say when somebody answers me that question.
Yeah.
But, you know, that list may not be informed by the latest experience as well. You know, there's new apps coming out all the time. So, yeah, it's good to have those kind of resources around. And it's just needed,
you
know, until Apple sort of, I don't know, solves the problem of app discovery. But how do you solve the problem of app discovery for 1.2 million apps?
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, it is huge, and I was talking to somebody just the other day about it, in terms of the comparison between the Apple App Store and other kind of equivalents of that with Android, and I think the App Store is a lot more discriminatory, and you do get much more quickly to the kind of apps you're looking for, but even so, we know what it's like, just you've got such a big sort of ocean of apps to kind of find your way through.
Yeah. I mean, I think the other part of that conversation is that, you know, when we started with iPad in school, the way that we figured out which apps were good is that we got them and put them out for all the kids, and then we found out whether it worked or not.
Yeah.
And I think after a couple of years of that, you start to get a much more kind of spidey sense about, you know, I've downloaded this to my own iPad and it doesn't pass the sniff test, so I'm not going to bother. You know, but starting out schools, nobody's got that capability.
No, but I think what's good about for all the schools that are thinking about going one-to-one or going with the iPad is that I think that the kind of like backpack of apps, if you like, is lighter. You know, it is for starting out, certainly, is not like a huge kind of case full of hundreds of apps.
Yeah.
And I often say to schools, you know, I could give you maybe 8 or 10 apps, and if you just have those 8 or 10 apps, you could do transformative work in your classrooms.
So I'm going to, we haven't discussed this already, but I'm going to guess what your list is.
Yeah, okay.
And we'll see if you're right. So it's going to be Pages, Keynote, Numbers, GarageBand.
Yeah.
iMovie.
Yeah, so that's your Apple Suite. So they're already
Apple
there.
Suite. Yeah. Explain Everything.
Yeah.
Book Creator.
Yeah.
Any more we'd add to that? So a drawing program like Brushes or ArtRage?
Yeah, like I mean, I mean, they are the main ones. I probably would throw in maybe, certainly for the stage I'm teaching at, Puppet Pals.
Some kind of animation tool.
Although you can do a lot of these things in Explain Everything, it just varies a little bit. And from there on, you're really at kind of, you're looking at other apps that just tweak and adapt things that you can already do with some of these other ones. So like Morpho and Telegami, for example, where it just adds another little dimension.
There's
to what
specialized
you
tools for one particular approach that you might take. Yeah.
I mean, look, these tools are huge. Mm-hmm. You look at like something like Explain Everything, for example, where you know, you can build that into a workflow, which is a powerful tool, you know, either from you delivering to the students or the students feeding back to you. And you can now obviously use it as part of an assessment tool. You can, you know, mark PDFs of assignments in there, and there's just so much you can do.
I think it's challenging for a new teacher coming new to iOS. And I think if there's something that I feel perhaps kind of failed at over the past year, it's not presenting people with enough ideas to get them started.
Yeah.
Because I'm aware now that when we're sort of advocating this kind of very content-free toolbox approach to apps, that it places an intense burden on the teacher to think up what they're going to do. And I think there are some teachers who are perfectly capable of that, and they've been waiting for these tools all their life, and they're ready to fill that void with ideas.
Yeah.
And there are other teachers who don't understand how to even begin.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the challenges, more than just finding the apps. It's getting teachers thinking about how they could actually fill the lesson or integrate the technology into the lesson in a way that is educationally valid and useful.
Yeah.
And I know that I've been talking a lot more about things like the SAMR model,
mm-hmm.
and the TPAC model as two ways to not just grade the quality of what you do, but also just get started.
Yeah.
You know, and to explicitly make it clear that it's okay just to do a what you might call a substitution step at the start. You know, take out a stopwatch and put in a timer app. It doesn't set the world on fire. It's not the reason you buy an iPad, but it gets you over the hurdle of, and now I'm doing something with the iPad.
Yeah.
And then what do we do next, and what do we do next?
Absolutely. And one of the slides I quite often show as part of my one of our presentations is one of a kid with a textbook, and just beside the iPad is a calculator.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes people are kind of like, well, that's not very transformative. And it isn't.
Yeah.
But it is the iPad as part of what we do and what we're doing.
Yeah.
You know,
There's so many parts to this conversation, because we, you know, the other conversation that we've had a lot is people ask all the time, and I'm sure they ask you as well, like what's your electronic book strategy? And we don't have one.
No.
Right? And this was a conversation we had with the English teachers earlier on this school year. You know, I said, look, do you want to do this book rental thing so we can have all these books on an iPad? And said, we don't want to do that, because we don't want to lock up the iPad as a book.
Yeah.
When I could get a paper book, which lasts longer, is cheaper, and then the iPad could be free to actually work on.
Absolutely. Right? And that talks very much to kind of like, I mean, I love iBooks Author. I mean, mm-hmm. I just love iBooks Author, and I've done so much with it. But that was my initial response to iBooks Author, was kind of like, well, that looks amazing and I have to find a way of using that, but I don't want it to be just for making a textbook, because that will then mean that my iPad is a textbook.
Yeah.
And I want my iPad in my classroom to be a whole bunch more than a textbook.
Yeah. I mean, I think so much of the iPad is textbook strategy kind of speaks to the religious status of the textbook in American education.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we don't have that culture in Scotland,
no, we don't.
Or even the UK, where the textbook is A, very expensive, and B, it is the sort of be all and end all of so much teaching that that people sort of equate textbook with learning. We don't sort of see it that way.
No.
We've always looked at the textbook as much more of a support for what happens in the classroom. So there's that part too. I need to unwind this conversation, because what were we talking about before?
Before we hit iBooks Author.
Before we talked about iBooks Author, we talked about teachers getting started. I've completely
lost. We're talking about the toolbox of apps.
The toolbox of apps, yeah.
And looking at ones that kind of fitted into our workflow, small numbers of apps rather than huge kind of like boxes.
Yeah, that whole idea of apps being sort of content free, I think it's that's been a major change, I think, for us over the course of not just this year but the last few years.
Yep.
That instead of putting in apps with content, well, we still do some of that. But very rarely is that, like, we wouldn't even build a term around one app.
No.
You know, I mean, that would basically never happen.
Yeah, I think some of what I try and do whenever I'm kind of doing iPad training with teachers, especially kind of ones that are just beginning, is just to say to them, okay, no matter who you are, what stage you teach, what subject you teach, by the time you finish this hour or whatever it is time we've got together, you will have something that you can do tomorrow in your classroom.
Yeah.
That you can actually say, I've got a reason for using the iPad, and I'm going to do that. Yeah. And you can use that anywhere. So it might be something like, you know, we do a little bit of work with Explain Everything, and you can say to them, well, you can be doing now, if you're a French teacher, you can be doing weather reports in French from in front of the Eiffel Tower with a picture of your child then reporting from there. Or if you're an English teacher, you're maybe doing a scene from Romeo and Juliet that you've kind of animated in Puppet Pals or Explain Everything, you know, that we're just showing them something and saying, well, you guys can do, you can use the iPad, and it makes sense, and it makes what you do better, and it enhances what you do, and here's how easy it is to get started.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think I've remembered what I wanted to talk to you about on that whole line of, you know, having the iPad just as a calculator or something like that, was this idea that I've put a new slide into my presentation about this as well, where I talk about apps being pencils and not books. And I think and the picture I used to illustrate it is actually from your class this year,
mm-hmm.
With the Ideal Homes project that you did. And the way that I described this was that, I mean, why don't you tell people what the project was first then?
Yeah, so basically we were looking at, the overall project was about homes and buildings, and it was a project that looked at kind of ranged pretty wide from kind of architecture and styles, and it looked at a lot of environmentally, you know, eco energy, and we went to the wind farm and we went to the nuclear power station and we looked at how solar panels worked, and we did a whole bunch of stuff like that. We looked at materials, we looked at design, and we looked at kind of main, the children all chose kind of iconic buildings in the world and sort of looked at them and said what was great about them. And so there was a lot of elements to it, but one of the kind of final outcomes was that over the course of the term at home, with the help from parents and other adults, they built their own inverted commas ideal home. So they looked at various different guidelines and they used them to build this ideal home. And they then, we had an Ideal Homes exhibition, we invited in the public and parents and so on, and they had to present about their home alongside the model with a video presentation on their iPad running as they did. And they had to answer questions and speak to a whole panel of judges about why they'd made the choices that they'd made and so on. So that was kind of really basically what you saw when you came to view it.
To see the whole thing, yeah. And the way I've been describing that in presentations that I've done recently is that nothing about the assessment of that project is a digital artifact.
Yeah.
Right? The assessment is based on the child's spoken performance in front of the judges.
Yep.
Again, back to the presentation skills and the confidence. And secondly, the model construction.
Yep.
But you can't score highly in the model construction unless you've done solid research, you've put together your ideas well, you've executed your plans. And the way that I try and sort of illuminate the role of the iPad in that to people is that every single step along the way, you had to, we didn't have to, but it was always to your advantage to be very skilled on the iPad or in terms of the creating things on the computer to support your learning so that you could build and build and build to the point where you could execute a good construction of a house and you actually knew enough to talk to the judges.
Yeah.
And the iPad all the way along in that project is not, it's never the thing you're going to score on. But unless that's there as a fundamental skill, you can't score highly on the rest.
Absolutely. And that's really interesting you saying that, because it's something that I'm actually kind of like, I'm becoming more and more interested in, is the link between the technology and the physical kind of aspect of learning.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, basically the link between, you know, whether learning about how to play in the key of C in GarageBand links and how it links to actually picking up a guitar.
Yeah.
You know, or whether using ArtRage and how using ArtRage actually impacts picking up a paintbrush.
Yeah.
And it is, I think there's a really interesting link there somehow, and I've not really thought this through thoroughly myself, but it was very much part of that project where the iPad was a fundamental part of that project, but it was a fundamental part that never really reared its head above the parapet, if you like.
Yeah.
It was always there under the bonnet, but it was never the kind of like thing that that was visible in the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was never, the marking was not about a digital artifact.
Yeah.
But it was about learning that was completely informed by the experience of being a network student.
Yeah.
I think is probably the way I would
describe
it.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
And I thought that, I think that's a fascinating thing to try and stretch out for people. You know, the part of my presentation where I talk about that, you know, I've talked about simple things, and that one just takes it to a whole different level of, okay, now this is actually a different world that we're dealing with here,
yeah.
Which is not, it's not just about, it's not just about making something on the iPad and getting scored for that. But it's about performing your knowledge that fundamentally came from the network,
yeah.
In a way, you know, that, you know, so, I mean, April did that project and so much of what she learned in that project came from the internet.
Yeah.
You know, it came from her own research from, you know, the biggest research library that we have ever constructed on the planet,
yeah.
Which is the internet.
Yeah. And, but a lot of that, you know, there was a whole bunch of learning on the other side of that, which was kind of like, what questions do you need to ask?
Yeah.
How do you approach the internet? What do you need to say to the internet in order to mm-hmm. get to where you want to get to?
Yeah.
And that was really, really interesting.
And that learning question is not just, like, I love the way you said that there. What do you have to say to the internet? It's not just, what do you have to type into Google?
Yeah.
It's how do you operate as an actor in the network that gets you the knowledge that you need to perform at the level that's expected yeah. of you? And this is something I've been thinking about a lot as you know, the growth of Curriculum for Excellence has come up against the exam system that has kind of grown down from the other side
yeah.
and has been kind of, you know, worked backwards from university level, is that they actually overshoot each other quite dramatically, in that what our students can do coming through these years and years of very progressive education, and then what they're asked to do technologically at that sort of boundary between the non-exam system and the exam mm-hmm. system, is these two things are actually missing each other by quite a distance.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we're talking about the kind of projects that kids are doing at age 10 and 11. And then when they get up to be 14, they're being asked to add two slides to a PowerPoint yeah. presentation and put a couple of pictures in. And we're actually missing each other by a very, very, yeah. very long
yeah.
way.
Yeah, and maybe some of that, I mean, they would obviously know how to do that, no problem. But yeah. it's kind of like maybe some of that they do without even knowing that that what they're doing.
Yeah.
They just know that they're how to do that because yeah. it's part of life. And it's also, I think, quite interesting when you think about, like, the beginnings of teaching with the internet, where people had huge concerns about, you know, well, they'll just cut and paste stuff off the internet.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking, like, with this project and other ones like it that we've done over the course of the year, there's increasingly this interaction with the internet, which is learning in itself. You know, it's all about how do I get what I want to get? What do I want to get? Why do I need to get that? And how is that going to inform my end product? So what they're actually doing at the end of the day is a completely individual outcome.
Mm-hmm.
But it is utterly dependent on stuff that they may well have just copied and pasted from the internet.
Yeah.
But it's the application of that and the knowledge and the learning about where did you go for that? Why did you go there?
Mm-hmm.
And what was the question you were asking in the first place?
And how did
it work out for you? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with a guy called James Bridle on the internet. He's associated with a whole kind of intellectual movement called the New Aesthetic. And he's a blogger and he's written, I love everything he writes, but one thing that always stuck in my mind from something he wrote was he said, and I'm quoting this from memory, so forgive me if I get it wrong, but he said, I despise the narrative that says we're all flighty and distracted. Yes, my knowledge is hard to quantify, but it plays in a vastly greater sphere than ever before in human history. Something like that,
yeah.
you know, and,
yeah.
and I think that's what we're starting to kind of see come into the school.
Yeah.
Is that, and we saw it in early days with things like students emailing experts,
yeah.
and those were like the baby yeah. steps of that world. And now we're starting to see it's starting to snowball into yeah. something that's very different.
Yeah, and it's interesting because sometimes you can look at these things and you think, well, we're talking about a massive, kind of a huge vision, and what's the point when really we want to be kind of keeping our feet on the ground? But in actual fact, it's like the shoots of that vision are kind of like budding all around us, and we're starting to see it being driven from the ground up, you know, it's
yeah.
actually becoming manifest in the way the kids are learning, and in some ways without us designing it to be like that, but it's mm-hmm. almost a feature of the way that our school is now.
Yeah.
And the potential that there is now.
Yeah. It's, you know, at some level you're starting to realise what you've actually just done.
Yeah.
You know, and it's way bigger. Yeah, than,
absolutely.
You know, and I kind of feel like the genie can't be put back in the bottle now. You know, there's enough students now. I mean, what is that? It's, you know, the kids who started with the first 5-year-olds to get an iPad are now, what, 8 or 9?
Mm-hmm.
You know, 9, 10.
Yeah, 9.
9, mm-hmm. 10. And within a couple more years, they're going to be half of our school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, we're 4 years into now, another 3 years from now, fully half the school
will never have known life.
Will never have known education without an iPad. Yeah. And give it another 6 years, that's only 2 refreshes. The entire school will have been brought up this way.
Yeah.
And I think it's there's something about that. There's something about that kind of critical culture. I'm actually going to quote you from a book here that I've got. This is The Children's Machine by Seymour Papert. And I'm going to try and dig out the quote that I used before, which I really, really liked. Yeah. The context is he's talking about a robotics project that he went to in a school, and things happened there that hadn't been planned for in the project. And what he says was, he says, the robotics project provides a simple example of what I call second-order effects or systemic effects of the computer presence. The school did not spend thousands of dollars on computers specifically so that students could have the experience of witnessing a spontaneous alliance amongst three teachers from strongly separate departments. Computers are usually introduced to achieve specific educational objectives, and their first-order effects are measured by looking at how well those objectives are achieved. But to an extent that varies enormously from school to school, the computer presence can come to play a less specific but potentially more powerful role. By entering the culture of the school, it can weave itself into learning in many more ways than its original promoters could possibly have anticipated.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
And I think that's the world that we're starting to see.
And I think we're starting to see it not because we, because it's happening, basically.
Yeah. You know? It's happening because it's happening.
Yeah.
And I think it, you know, what he writes there is correct as well, that that's not something that we necessarily plan for.
Yeah. I think that's true.
You know.
But it's exciting.
It absolutely is. Man, this is going to be a long show because we're only two-thirds of the way into it. Let me talk about the last sponsor here, and then we'll do the last section we're going to talk about. Our friends at Jam Software, who have been super supportive of this show for years, I guess, now. Jam Software make the Casper suite, which we use. I was just working on it today, wrapping up our school year. It provides ICT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies, such as Macs, iOS devices, and Apple TVs in education. And with Casper Focus, they've placed these technologies directly into the hands of teachers who work with students every day. Casper Focus allows teachers to quickly gain students' attention, conduct secure exams, and select specific Apple TVs assigned to the class, distribute iBooks, and even initiate AirPlay right from Casper Focus. And you can learn what else you can do with Casper Focus at jamfsoftware.com. That's jamfsoftware.com. It's interesting to think about that in context of the discussion we just had. Like, can we even hold it back? Even with Casper Focus, can you hold back what's going on in the classroom now?
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge question.
And it's interesting that you need something like that to get down to secure exams.
Yeah.
You know, you have, how much you have to, if you think about the conversation we just had, and then what's offered through Casper Focus, as, you know, and don't get me wrong, Casper Focus is the same technologies we use for our digital exams. Like, how much of what we've just talked about is just carved out and hollowed out when you say this iPad can only use this one app?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and not on the network.
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge question. And I mean, I think sometimes, I mean, I know that, for example, sometimes as a teacher, practically the truth is, that's what I want.
Yeah.
You know, and it, to be honest, every day is not a kind of like blue sky day.
You've still got to come out spelling and adding up.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And I think these things, sometimes these are the foundations that you need to be able to have a blue sky day, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like having your to-do list, right? Yeah. If you don't have a to-do list, you don't know what you can blow off and not do.
Yeah, yeah.
We could talk for hours about this. What was our last topic? Yeah, we're going to try and
talk about the conference.
Bring some more of this to other people.
Yeah. Yes.
So tell me about this.
Yeah, so I'm really looking forward
to this.
This
is really your baby rather than mine, even though I'm claiming the credit for it.
Oh, well, you're the guy that'll bring everybody in, hope.
Oh.
So we're going to do this conference. It's the 11th of September.
Mm-hmm.
It's in a fantastic venue in Glasgow called the Teacher Building, which... although it sounds very appropriate for education, I think it's actually ultimately began as a kind of whiskey distillery.
Yes, I've been common with the foundations of most of the Scottish economy. You know, alcohol is involved, yes.
Yeah, although it won't be on the particular day of the conference.
Yes, no, it will be a dry conference, I'm sorry to say. This isn't South by Southwest.
No, although it might make things a little bit more interesting. But no, it should be a fantastic conference. I mean, I think certainly my idea was... the idea of kind of like we get so many invitations to go out to other schools and to go to places, and you can sometimes go to, you know, groups of 10, 20 teachers here, there, and I just thought it would be nice to bring us all together and give people the chance to, well, come together and meet with other like-minded schools and be able to talk to people that are on the same sort of journey, and mm-hmm. and also specifically just to listen to people like you and obviously Abdul's coming up as well, who are the guys who have the answers to, you know, okay, we want to do this in our school, how do we do it, you know, ask us some questions, you want to know anything at all, well, this is the place to find out.
Yeah, so one of the things I've become concerned about over this year is the kind of ad hoc nature of many iOS deployments
mm-hmm.
in schools. That I've got a background in systems administration, I always, whenever somebody tells me about what they're going to do with technology, I always think, well, that's great. What happens when the year ends and you've got to move all this technology on to next year? And very often I'm hearing a story that I know is just going to become a train wreck 1 year from now when you've got to change everything again. Yeah. You know, the crazy ideas that people have about Apple IDs, for example.
Yeah.
And everybody thinks they've found some way to game Apple and get around the way you're supposed to do these things. And I suppose one of the things we're probably going to say at the conference is don't try that.
Yeah.
But what I hope for my contribution to the conference is that that people will understand the kind of value of an ordered deployment, you know, that makes sense, is actually managed and not controlled in the wrong sense, but sort of, I suppose managed is the word, right?
Yeah.
That is brought in an orderly fashion in a way that not only works, but is repeatable year on year.
Yeah.
Right. So now we're finishing our fourth year of deploying iPads, and every year, you know, technology has moved on, but every year there's been a coherent deployment that makes sense and works.
Yeah.
And it works in one way for the whole year. And then maybe the next year it's going to work a slightly different way because there's new technology. But we've never had to redo it halfway through the year because we got something wrong. And I want that to be the experience of more schools.
Yeah.
That's important to me.
Absolutely. And from my point of view, I mean, the bit that I do in education in terms of in the classroom and love doing with the iPad is really only possible if it's done properly in the first place.
Yeah.
And teachers in the classroom don't want to have to deal with problems with technology like we've dealt with so many other examples of technology through the years. It needs to work. It just needs to be simple, and it needs to be able to do the things that we've just spoken about tonight.
Yeah.
And I would really like for teachers to be able to come along and schools to be able to get a chance to actually be put on the right track and to do that properly.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Because you can't achieve those heights unless you completely depend on the technology. And I think if there's one thing we've done right as a school and I've done right as an admin, it's you never think about whether or not you're going to have enough storage space. You never think about whether or not the network is going to cope with what you want to do.
Yeah.
You never have to think about whether or not you've got to carve 20 minutes off the end of your lesson to download all the files from these iPads so they can go somewhere else because we're deploying them in carts rather than as a one-to-one program or something like that. And even if your school's not wholly one-to-one, although that increasingly I'm confident in saying that's what makes a difference, there are ways to sort of fake one-to-one. And you're actually better off faking one-to-one by time slicing it than trying to make it work in a different way.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, there's stories we could tell of schools where, you know, a whole new school has been built and there's one access point for like 800 students.
Yeah.
You know, things like that. You know, how can we offer them the things that we've talked about tonight in a world where those fundamentals aren't even there?
Yeah. I mean, I know that, you know, dealing with resellers and speaking to resellers, and sometimes I've said to them, you know, we do APD, but one of the kind of fundamentals of that has got to be vision and plan. And it's almost like, well, forget buying any iPads until you've actually, somebody's sat you down and made you say, well, why do you think the iPad's the solution?
Yeah.
What is it you want to solve in the first place?
Yeah.
Why do you want to do this? And actually make them think, what are we trying to do here?
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I did a thing not so long ago at a school where I opened the presentation by saying, look, I'm going to tell you about the way our school went one-to-one iPad, But if you go away from my presentation thinking that iPad is the point and not one-to-one, then I have failed to communicate to you what I mean. And then the first question I got after it was, well, why are we choosing iPad? I was like, that's the sound of me slapping myself in the face. You know, the iPad is just the thing for now.
Yeah.
Right. And there may be better things in the future, right? But, you know, the discussion then was about, well, businesses are all still running Windows, right? And so that's a legacy technology problem at this point. And what the way people are running Windows now is they're running it through a remote desktop on an iPad. That's what British Airways are doing. That's what all the supermarkets are doing.
Yeah.
Some crappy legacy back-end Windows system that they can't get off because they can't afford it, or the person who has got all the passwords is dead now or something like that. But they can still project the user interface out through an iPad, and that's actually what the form factor that people are using. So, I'm sure businesses run Windows, but they don't run very well on Windows. I mean, witness how long you have to wait at the bank to get it done now. You know. So anyway, to get back off that high horse. Yeah, I think the conference, for me, it feels like it's for school leaders.
Yep.
It's for lead teachers involved in one-to-one deployments.
Yep.
It doesn't have to be iPad specifically, although iPad's going to dominate the conversation just because it dominates the conversation.
Yep.
But it's also not Scotland-specific.
Nope.
It's very much an international level of focus, and whatever you come and learn at the conference will apply to you, whether you're trying to satisfy Common Core in the US, or you know, come from Australia if you want to. I know we've got some Australian listeners. Anybody worldwide will get value out of this.
Yeah, definitely. And I think in concert with the kind of practical side of it, what I would love is it to be inspirational, and I just would like it to be something that inspires people. And with yourself, obviously, and also Abdul's from ESA Academy is going to come up and do part of the day, which is great, and I've done a lot of work, and you have as well, obviously, with him over the years, and that's going to be great to have him. And we've got other folks as well coming to do different bits and pieces, and I think it should be a really good day.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it, and I think if anybody who's listening wants to sign up and come, we would be delighted to have you. Maybe next week we'll organise a little discount code for listeners of the show. We'll maybe bring that up. We've only just put the website live, so don't register until you hear the code. But technologyforexcellence.com is the website, and you'll find a schedule there and some speaker bios and information about where it is and so on and where it is as well. So, yeah, check that out. We'd love to see you there.
Absolutely.
All right, so, my goodness, what time is it now? Yep, this has been a long one. But listen, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
I really appreciate it. It's been a great conversation. I think it's been great to have that conversation just as we wrap up the year as well, you know, just to recognise what's actually happening. And sometimes just, when you put it into words, it makes some kind of sense, but you also continue to realise the enormity of what has happened, is happening, and I think is also yet to happen as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So thanks for having me.
Let's leave it there. Thanks to our sponsors. We've got Geeks with Juniors, a great website for finding new apps for students. We've got Shobi, a really great compliment to iTunes U for dealing with student assignments and handed and so on. And of course, our good friends at Jam Software, makers of the Casper Suite Mac and iOS deployments. So Andrew, where can people find you online?
So they can follow me at Andrew Jewell on Twitter. Or they can have a look at my website, which is andrewjewelleducation.com. Or they can drop me an email, which is just andrewjewel@me.com.
Okay, and I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter, spears.org on the web. And we'll talk to you all next week.